All right, welcome to the next sub-brief here. Before we get started, we do want to go over our sources because I always like to thank everyone up front. And of course, at the top of the list, we have Saturnax, who came through in a big way. He gave me multiple photos for every platform. So we got some good dry dock stuff coming up for you. Anyway, big hats off to Saturnax. As always, he comes through in every one of these sub-briefs, making these visually more compelling than just me talking. But we had a lot of really good Patreon participation this time. A lot of you guys gave me some great photos or information or both, like Server Wizard, Dan Bay, MD Thomas Photos. Your photos were volunteered to me, so thank you for being a part of this, even though I didn't talk to you personally. Blair Siegel, Dane Eckerman, Witz Wolf gave me some great links, some good research material from Witz Wolf, Andy Osborne, and a Patreon simply known as G. So I wonder if that'll start a thing where we get all the letters of the alphabet, and then maybe some Chinese characters eventually, where everyone just takes one letter. That'd be kind of cool. We did use the Canadian Forces O-Class training notebook, even though we are not going to get into the Canadian Forces in this lecture. That's going to be in the next one. They had some great references and materials, details about how the diesels worked and all that in this training notebook, so we still used it. My primary sources for the web information was seaforces.org and maritime.org. Because this is not a Russian lecture, we don't have that awesome resource of deepstorm.ru, where we get the detailed breakdown of every single underway. Unfortunately, we don't have that. This one will be a little more generalized than the Russian one. So I want you to know that up front before we get into it. All right, let's go. Royal Navy Oberon, SSK, the O class. Sub-brief. All right, so the Oberon is the follow-on, or the next version of the Porpoise submarine. The submarine that they built right after World War II, based on the German Type 21 U-boat, was the Porpoise. And the Oberon is essentially just an improved Porpoise. It has the same shape. Exterior-wise, it looks the same. It's got the same little sonar dome thing on the nose there. The sail is the same size. It displaces about the same. It's a little bit more because they have heavier steel and whatnot, but length and beam are the same. So you would be forgiven if you confused a Porpoise submarine on the surface sitting next to an Oberon. They look nearly identical. There are minor differences that I'll try to point out as they come up. But yeah, like I said, the Oberon is the direct follow-up. The Porpoise was built from 1956 to 1959, and she served all the way through the 80s. So the Porpoise was a good design, but what the Oberon did was they simply made the steel stronger so she could dive a little bit deeper and significantly quieter, and the Porpoise was already a quiet boat. So just a quieter Porpoise is the Oberon. And the Porpoise was intended as a patrol submarine, but they ended up using it as an attack submarine too, and they built 8 Porpoises, but they were going to build 27 Oberons. So the Oberon was clearly more successful. But this is where they came from. All right, so the Oberon construction, let's get into Oberon now. It begins in 1957, continues through to 1978. They built 27 of these in 4 different shipyards: Camel Lard, Chatham Dockyard, Scott's Shipbuilding and Engineering Company, and Vickers Armstrong's. Now, a lot of these companies went out of business or bankrupt and came back as different names over the years. So, but I tried to keep the names accurate to the time period of when these Oberons were constructed, 1957 to 1978. Okay, so the Oberon SSK by the numbers, what are we talking about here? We've got, a 90-meter length with an 8-meter width, that comes out to 26.5 feet approximately. She drafts only 5.5 meters, so she sits pretty high up in the water. There's a lot of a lot of freeboard there. She displaces 2,400 tons and has a speed of about 17 knots submerged sustained. She can make it a full 10,000 nautical miles without needing to have the diesel fuel replenished, and she has a crew of approximately 69 sailors. Pushing the submarine through the water are 2 Admiralty Strange Range V16 diesel engines, producing just a little under 3,700 horsepower apiece. She has 2 1,280 kilowatt generators, two electric motors turning the shafts of three blades apiece. Each one of those motors is 3,000 horsepower. So pretty good horsepower for this relatively light displacement boat. She has six forward torpedo tubes. She can store up to 20 torpedoes or up to 50 mines in the forward torpedo room. And she has two aft-facing 53-centimeter torpedo tubes with no stowage. So they go to sea with those two tubes loaded, and they keep them loaded. They're also special electric torpedoes that they use back there that we'll go over. All right, let's talk about the four shipyards that they build these in. Kamel Lard was founded in 1828 on the River Mersey in Liverpool City region. So those of you that are big football fans know where Liverpool is. A very popular club over there. 130 acres is the total size of the shipyard. She has four dry docks. She built a total of four of these Oberon submarines. She also builds and repairs commercial ships, offshore oil platforms, and has a civilian nuclear power plant process. She currently refits and repairs Royal Navy ships. Very successful shipyard. Chatham Dockyard, building naval vessels since 1567. One of the oldest dockyards in European history. She employs over, or employed, past tense, over 10,000 skilled workers. The size of the place was like a campus. It was 400 acres of shops and dry docks and warehouses. She built six of these Oberon submarines, but after 1984, she was divided up into three sections. Chatham Historical Dockyard, which is like a museum preservation site. Medway Ports Authority, which is like a yacht club where you can park your sailboat. And they continue to have commercial vessels in urban regions around the University of Medway and a marina, which is the third and final part of this ex-shipyard. So it's more of a historical site now, even though they do some work and they have a marina there, but they also have a really popular university. It's become literally a campus. There's an application to make the historical section of this a World Heritage Site. At the time of this recording, there was no definitive answer on that, but that would be really great if they did get that approved. Scott's Shipbuilding and Engineering Company, founded in 1711 and failed in 1993, located in Scott's on the River Clyde. She invented the A snorkel for submarines in 1917, but like a lot of other snorkel designs, it was not used. Everyone was trying to get submarines to be able to recharge their batteries via a snorkeling system submerged in the, you know, 1800s or the 18s and the 20s of the 20th century. And so she was just another one of those designs. She did successfully, you know, design it, but they never used it. During World War II, she built three cruisers, 20 destroyers, very busy shipyard, and 12 submarines during the war. In 1961, the shipyard was repurposed to build tankers and bulk carriers. The submarines, the Oberons, were built from 1959 to 1975 here, and she built 11 of them. She's up in Scotland. You can see where the little red mark is on the map on the right. That's the location of the shipyard. Oh, the top picture I should point out to you, because these are very impressive people. These are naval architects. They design ships from a blank piece of paper, doing all the calculations that are done today by computer. They do that by hand, and it's a very time-consuming process, and you have to be a brilliant, you know, mathematical person to be able to do what those people are doing. They're literally designing ships and calculating the center of gravity versus the center of buoyancy and the mass and displacement and how stable is it going to be. All that is done by hand, and very impressive. That's called the drawing room, because that's where the ship's drawings are. All right, Vickers Armstrongs, also known as Vickers Shipbuilding and Engineering, and half another dozen different names. This shipyard changes its names as much as a Cold War era submarine changes its name, it seems. They founded it in 1871 as Iron Shipbuilding Company. Then she was renamed Barrow Shipbuilding Company. She's located in Barrow-in-Furness in England. In 1955, she became Vickers Armstrongs, and that's the name that she was when she built the six Oberon submarines. So for this purposes of this lecture, it's Vickers Armstrongs. But in 1988, she had this. There's a famous mistake made by this shipbuilding company where a Triumph-class submarine, that's one of the nuclear submarines, had one of the sections welded 180 degrees upside down. So as you're walking through the submarine, you would walk from one deck to another, but you would see, if you look left and right, all the lockers were hung upside down. And nobody said anything during the construction. The shipyard workers were just following the plans. They're like, I'm supposed to weld this joint to this joint, therefore I will. But of course, none of the piping lined up. So eventually, somebody had to say something, and it wasn't until after they had welded the outside of the hull together that somebody finally said, hey, we've welded the submarine together 180 degrees out. And so we've got to cut these welds now and rotate this section of submarine and weld it back again so everything lines up properly. And that made the news and was a big debacle back in the day. One of the estimates in 1988 said it would take over $1 billion to fix. Of course, it didn't take that much, but that's how they ran with it. And, you know, that's a testament to where if you're in a position where you see something obviously not right, just say something, man. But nobody wanted to say anything. And that says something about the work culture at the place, too. Maybe people that pointed out problems were, transferred or dealt with poorly or something. So there was probably a little bit of that going on, too. Okay, and then finally in 2007 became part of BAE Systems Submarine Solutions, which is the name that they go by today. And BAE is a conglomerate of lots of different little companies. You know, it gets a little bit complicated when you start talking about these military industrial complex companies because they're like lots of little companies that are also under the umbrella of a larger one. And it's like a shell game of Russian dolls. You open up one and you find one more. You're like, well, okay, what's this one called? Yeah. All right. So the lead boat for the Oberon class was SO9 or S09, HMS Oberon. She was laid 1957, launched 1958, commissioned in 1961. That's a pretty good turnaround for a lead boat in a class. Some of the details about working and living inside these small diesel boats is the mess decks were also the crew's sleeping area. So the crew must have been on some kind of 24-hour cycle where they all slept at about the same time. That is much different than the way the submarines operate today, where there is somebody always in the rack sleeping around the clock, and you just wake up for your shift, and then you rotate right back to the rack again. Well, they couldn't do that because they needed to use the crew sleeping area as the crew's mess. And it was also the lounge area, the only place on board where they could sit down and have a card game, a social area, watch some television, maybe listen to some music. There was a few stories of people actually sleeping in their rack as the crew's mess is being used to watch television. So the guys are all huddled around the television with the volume really low as not to disturb the people sleeping. And the people sleeping are trying to get some sleep with the TV on just a few feet away from them. So imagine what that must have been like. Tot time was a daily ration of rum announced by the call Up Spirits. This practice was stopped in the 1970s, but they used to drink rum on these submarines. And I'm sure that was a nice daily event that they always look forward to. Religious services were held in the torpedo room on Sundays. They were overseen by an officer with a hymn book. He would read a few passages and then sing Those Who Peril on the Seas or a song like that, a naval song. And it was usually a short, simple service. But these men did observe religious practices while underway. All right, so let's talk about some of the systems on these here submarines. Torpedo and fire control systems, like I said, they have six forward torpedo tubes. The British ones could carry the Mark 24 Tigerfish or the Mark 8 torpedoes. The two aft torpedo tubes were shorter, so they had a small torpedo called the Mark 20S. The Mark 20 is a torpedo. The S is the submarine version of it, and it is a slightly shorter version of the torpedo. It's also passive homing, so you simply fire it and forget it because you're not controlling it. You're not going to do anything with it. It's almost a defensive weapon where if you think someone's behind you, because those are only in the aft-facing torpedo tubes, You would shoot one of those and try to get out of Dodge. It was retired in the 1980s, the Mark 20S, so they used those aft tubes for storage, which I'm sure was greatly needed in these small submarines. There you can see pictures of the torpedo control calculator Mark 17 and the torpedo director Mark 37-1. The little crosshairs you see on the right, there's actually two crosshairs there, but they're on top of each other, so it looks like one. The idea is the operator, after he shoots the tigerfish, which is wire-guided, he has to keep those crosshairs aligned. That's what the operator's doing. He's manually steering the weapon by keeping the crosshairs on top of each other. One crosshair represents the target's direction from the torpedo, and the other one is the torpedo's travel direction. So you want to match the travel direction with the target direction, and you'll score a kill. Okay, sonar hydrophones and comm systems, they put a lot on this little boat. I mean, just look at the number of arrays on this thing. They have multiple ultra-high frequency, high-frequency, very low-frequency radio receivers. She can do all the different spectrum bands. This is common on today's submarines, by the way. But, I mean, we're talking back in the late 1950s, whenever they're building and designing this. They put, you know, a VLF aerial recoverable buoy that they can float up to the top right there. The ALK, you see they tow it like a kite. And the mechanism to tow that thing is very complicated, can be noisy, can get jammed. You can only be at like 3 knots whenever you deploy and retrieve the thing, and then only like 5 knots whenever you have it deployed. So there's a lot of speed restrictions going on there. But it gives the submarine a great capability. You don't have to go to periscope depth to copy your radio traffic. You just float the buoy up, get your messages, bring it back in. You never have to change depth. And why is that important? Changing depth makes noise. So if you don't have to change anything, just reel out the kite, bring it back in, you know, and you're good to go. Now, if you look over on the right, you can see all the sonar arrays, and they had a ton of these things. They had underwater telephones for emergency use. They had a self-monitoring hydrophone. They had a sonar intercept, bearing recording hydrophone, and that's for active sonar, so if they get pinged, they at least have a direction that it came from. They also had a torpedo alarm. A lot of submarines, even in modern times, disable the torpedo alarm because the thing will just go off randomly, it seems. It's very easy to trick that thing to thinking there's a torpedo in the water, but they had it. But the main sonar is the medium range search attack set active mode. That's the big bulbous hump right on the bow, right on the top. That's an active transmitting transducer. Transducer means it can transmit and receive. It's got a range, active range out to 22,000 yards. Do not hang your hat on the acoustic range as detection range because that's not the same thing. What I believe it's saying is 22,000 yards was the maximum range it would look before it pinged a second time. They could, of course, come shorter than that, but that was the max one. And then, of course, it also had passive array, but the passive array was really weird on this. Is the passive array was down the side, what we call a flank array in today's Navy. So this must have been one of the first submarines to actually have an operational passive flank array going right down the side of the submarine. The fact that they got that to work in the 1950s, very good engineering. These guys knew what they were doing. All right, propulsion, diesel, batteries, and motors. What makes it go through the water is this right here. Like I said, we had two of the Admiralty Standard V16 diesels. We have two 3,000 horsepower electric motors turning the shafts. That's what the piece of equipment is on the left-hand side there. That's where you would change the speed of the electric motors turning the shafts to maintain whatever the ordered bell is. And over on the right hand side, you can see one of the two battery cells that it had holding 224 battery cells apiece. And so it's a lot of batteries, but this is a diesel boat. You'd expect them to have a good strong battery. In the early days of this submarine's life as a class, not just this one boat, the diesels would break down a lot. So they eventually got them working more reliable as the program went on. But in the beginning, there was a lot of stories of how they had to bob around on the surface for a little bit while they got the diesel repaired. Or, you know, one would break down, they would use the other one to get back to port because they had two of them. So in the beginning, there were some reliability issues with the diesel engines. Okay, So the next two that were built were S-10 and S-11. Very nice for the Royal Navy to be going in order, unlike other navies. I'm looking at you, Russia. HMS Odin was laid down in 1959, launched in 60, commissioned in 62. And her sister ship, S-11, HMS Orpheus, was built by Vickers Armstrong Shipbuilding, 1959. Both were decommed in 1990s. And these were really good special operation boats. So let's take a minute to look at a couple of the areas that they operated in. Almost all the boats always operated in the European Arctic region. Actually, all the boats operated up there, but they were up there more than any other area. This is where they like to go and operate. What did they do up there? Well, they went to periscope depth and they would listen for radio traffic. Some of them would drop off SBS Marines, which are like special forces, and recover them. And they would also sit on the bottom. They would get to really shallow water because their test depth was only like 650 feet. So they would find water that was like, you know, 500 feet or less. And they would just sit on the bottom and listen. Just see who's coming in and out of port, see what's going on, you know, in the vicinity of whatever port they happen to be in. It could be a NATO port, you know, but it was probably not. It was probably one of the other ports that you see on this map. She did do runs or operations in the Mediterranean and Baltic Sea. Those were not as frequent as the European Arctic region. They loved to send these boats up north. Keep in mind, it's during the Cold War, 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s. You know, some of these boats actually weren't decommissioned until 2000. So long running boats. All right, training boat and collision at sea. We have the HMS Opportune. She was laid down in 1962, launched 1964, and commissioned in 1964. She is the victim of this collision coming up. S-11, HMS Orpheus, who we were just talking about, in June 1965, she's down there in the Mediterranean Sea doing some training out of Balta. One of the things that they're doing is practicing submarine escape training, including a free ascent. That means holding your breath from 500 feet deep and crawling out of the submarine and going up to the top. Now, of course, they have a special device that they put over their head where they can breathe, exhale into. But the idea is if you pressurize the person in a trunk, then flood it, he can take a deep breath of air before it floods completely. And that air in his lungs is compressed air at 500 foot depth. So as he ascends through the water, and we practice this, okay? American and Royal Navy sailors have to do this in submarine school. As you ascend from what is normally a training depth would be like 80 feet, but he's doing this from 500 feet, you can feel your lungs expand like you're taking a deep breath. It's the craziest thing. So as he goes up, he's rising from 500 feet to 400 feet to 300 feet. He's actually expelling air out of his nose to keep water from coming in his nose and just ho-hoing all the way up to the surface, you know. And we would have to do that in sub school, but nobody ever did it from 500 feet. Apparently that was some kind of record whenever they did that in 1965. Canadian Australian crews who knew that they were going to be getting these submarines began training on the HMS Orpheus. So Orpheus was kind of a training vessel for future sailors from other countries. February 1967, though, she does collide with an Oberon submarine, HMS Opportune, in poor weather conditions outside Portsmouth Harbor. That's on the south side of England there. And the captain of the Orpheus was deemed at fault and court-martialed and disciplined. Yeah, they, you know, I don't know any of the details, but I know whenever you're traveling on the surface in poor visibility with fog, which is very common for that region of the world to have those low visibility situations, you know, you're really reliant on your radar information, and radar can reflect off fog too. So, you know, your sonar data, your sonar on the surface is out of the water. It's not doing you any good. So it was just a little bit of bad luck, but they deemed the captain of the Orpheus at fault and court-martialed him. All right. So the Falkland Island warboats, I included HMS Olympus in this, laid down in 1960, launched 1961, commissioned 1962, because she did depart Naval Base Davenport in April of 1982, and that's like when everybody was being scrambled down to the South Atlantic, and she did go to the South Atlantic. So at the very least, HMS Olympus was in region. But after scouring the Royal Navy websites, she was never publicly recognized for having a role in the Falkland Island War. So we know that she was in the area, but apparently she didn't do anything, or if she did do something, it's still not public, and that is a strong possibility. Now, the HMS Olympus did not have the five-man diving chamber to release SBS crews installed until after the war. She didn't get that installed until July of 1982, and by then the war was over. But who did have it was the Onyx. The Onyx did have that diving chamber installed in April of 1982. The Onyx was laid down in November 1964, launched in August 1966, commissioned in 67. So the Onyx had the five-man tube. They would go underway with SBS. Well, they would pick them up from, either an airdrop or do a personnel transfer at sea. The SBS did not ride on the submarine from England all the way down to the South Atlantic. No. Those guys flew in or parachuted in, were brought in later on. But eventually they found their way to the submarine, is my point. She's participating in the Falkland Island War, conducting special force insertion and reconnaissance all around the Falkland Islands. Whenever they were trying to figure out how they were going to invade the Falkland Islands, what beaches were they were going to come in on, they had to clear the beaches of obstructions, of mines. They had to recon the beaches because the maps that they had in 1982, even though they claimed the island, were not that detailed. There were some hand drawings that explorers had made, but they weren't the military grade maps that you would expect to plan an amphibious invasion around. So at the very least, they had to recon the beaches to see, you know, just how clear they actually were, and then clear them if they need to. She was also able to get very close to shore, much closer than the nuclear boats, because as we all know, the nuclear boats were down there as well. But because of her, you know, diesel boat capability, she's relatively small, displaces fewer tons. She's able to get, you know, real close, make the swim to shore very, very easy for the SBS guys. She does intercept hostile radio traffic and serve as a seaside base for the SBS Marine Special Forces during the entire war, and is highly recognized for her role in the Special Forces effort on the Falkland Islands. So well done to the Onyx for providing them that support. All right, a couple more Royal Navy Oberons was the HMS Osiris, built in Victor's Armstrong Shipyard, laid down 1962. November 1962, she was launched, and in January, she was commissioned 1964. Eventually decommissioned in 1989. This is one of the submarines that was sold to Canada for parts and then scrapped. So Canada will eventually get three of her own Oberons, and then she'll buy two more. One is basically a seaside training base. You know, it doesn't leave the pier. It's just for training. And then this other one was the Osiris. They bought her for parts, just so they could keep the other three running. Anyway, so HMS Onslaught S14 is built in Chatham Dockyard, Kent, UK. She's laid down in April 1959. She's launched in 1960 and commissioned in 1962. Now, these do have good careers like the other ones have. But the HMS Osiris is used for parts in the end. All right, Cold War Warriors. HMS Ocelot might be the most renowned, maybe the most famous of the Royal Navy Oberons, because these boys did a lot of good work. Ocelot was built in Kent, laid down 1960, launched 1962, commissioned in 1964. She is currently preserved at the Chatham Historic Dockyard. That's the one that they're trying to make a heritage site as well. In the 1960s, she participated in NATO war games and did some torpedo testing, but that wasn't where she got famous. She spent a lot of time up in the European Arctic region, sitting on the bottom at less than 650 feet, listening for Soviet naval ships to come out of the Kola Peninsula. There's lots of little naval bases up in the Kola Peninsula and the White Sea region, and she would get all the way up in there and just chill and do great recordings, made great reports of fleet activity up there. She was never caught, and always came back with the Jolly Roger flag, the pirate flag, if you will, for her exploits. She was a very active boat, went to sea a lot, didn't spend much time in port, basically came back to port for repairs, crew turnover, refresh and refill the food and oil, and right back at it. A very active, very successful boat, HMS Ocelot. All right, HMS Otter. She was built in Scott's Shipbuilding, January 14th, 1960. She was laid down, launched in 1961, commissioned in 1962, and eventually decommissioned in 1991. Nothing too remarkable about her career other than that she was doing the same thing a lot of the other boats were doing, intelligence collection. S-16 HMS Oracle was laid down in 1960, launched in 1961, commissioned in 63 and decommissioned in 93. A lot of these dates are very similar, 59 to early 60s, because they have four shipyards building these things at the same time. And some of the shipyards are building more than one at a time. So very, very active. But yeah, the HMS Oracle out there doing some good work. HMS Otis, she is laid down in 1961, launched in 62, commissioned in 63. And she is preserved as a museum or a memorial of some kind in Sassnitz, Germany. So if you're over on the German side of Europe, definitely check her out. S-19 is HMS Possum. She's laid down in 1961, launched in 63, commissioned in 64. So the cool thing about these two boats is they both participated in the first Persian Gulf War, the 1991 war, under Operation Granby. Now, Operation Granby involved all of the Royal Navy assets and Royal Marines, the Air Force, they all fell under the envelope of Operation Granby. So it wasn't just a naval operation by any stretch, but they were a part of it, and they conducted, surveillance and reconnaissance of shoreline. It was hampered in large part by the mines that the Iraqis had laid. They laid a lot of mines around Kuwait and their little sliver of the Persian Gulf shoreline before the war began. So they weren't always able to get as close as they wanted to be, but they were able to support the SBS, the Special Forces, again, like they had done in the Falkland Island War, from offshore. There's not a lot of details even today on the specifics of their mission because of the clandestine nature of the SBS. And we'll respect that here and just honor their service in the Persian Gulf War. They did a great job, and that story may never be told. All right, so yeah, my final thoughts on the Oberons, man. These are absolutely iconic Cold War era submarines. I don't always give the diesel boats the respect and credit that they are due, so let me do that now and say that I'm very impressed with the operational tempo, status, capabilities, and accomplishments these diesel boats did. They operated all over the place. South Atlantic, North Atlantic, Mediterranean, Arctic, and did a great job. Is extremely quiet boat. I mean, and diesel boats are quiet in general, but this is the kind of boat where the only way you're going to hear it is if the crew makes a mistake. Shuts a door, drops something metal on metal. You're going to hear that, but you're not going to hear it on its battery. No, very quiet submarine. Very impressed. It was great for the SBS Marine delivery and recovery missions. That was a big part of what they did. Outstanding reconning platform with her mast and antennas. She could just kind of sit there at periscope depth, raise her, radar direction finding masts and just listen to radio traffic. She did have severe depth limitations by modern submarine standards, but again, she is a diesel boat, smaller displacement. Even with the strengthened hull, she only had a test depth of 650 feet, and that is just not deep enough to be competitive in a submarine engagement. You got to be able to change depth quickly and by a lot, and she just did not have that capability. So she is technically classified a hunter-killer. And people will argue to the ends of the earth that she was great at hunter killing, but looking at her depth alone tells me that she would not survive a one-on-one submarine fight. She would not evade the torpedo that's going to be shot at her, is my point. She also had some engine reliability problems in the beginning. Those were improved. I don't think they were ever completely fixed. I think she kind of had the reliability problem her entire life, but they did get better as the submarine went on. But man, the sailors, let's give it up for the sailors of the Oberon class submarine. Like a good submarine sailor, they're all aggressive. They employed these subs to their limits. They did not exceed the limits. They did not sink any submarines. They did not, you know, they brought the submarine home every time, which is so important. But whenever they were deployed, they used it to its full capability. And that says a lot about the training and the commitment and the professionalism of these sailors to a man. I think we talked about only one collision in 4 decades of service today. So that is really good. Very well done. And that collision happened in conditions that, in my opinion, couldn't be helped. It was just low visibility. You see the ship right in front of you at the last second, and you don't have time to get out of the way. But that happens, you know. Anyway, so she served in many operations, including the Falkland Island War, Persian Gulf War. This is a Cold War warrior class submarine, and it has my greatest respect. And I think it should have yours as well. This is the Royal Navy O-Boats, the Oberon class SSKs. All right, so I want to say thank you to everyone for supporting me here on the sub brief, man. Like Anger, Jormungener, Brendan Ferry, DJS4000, Daniel Onlay, Jordan Vordraska, of course, Scott Borg and Sean O'Neill, two guys that have been division officers sent for 3 years now. Thank you guys. You guys rock. And of course, the Collier Report. Collier Report is a really great guy, and I had a chance to send him a message, and I want to just tell him thank you very much for supporting so many creators like myself. He is extremely generous, and I do appreciate that. So thank you all for watching. I'm going to get this edited and up for you as fast as I can. And the next one that's coming out is going to be part two of this series, where we talk about the Canadians and the Brazilians and the Chileans. And of course, those crazy Australians. They had a couple of these too. And those stories are going to be great. All right. I'll see y'all then.